The views expressed and the opinions given by the individual host, guest, random reptoid, or chupacabra may not necessarily reflect those of AM 950 Radio, its affiliates, or its sponsors. Now, it's time to step into the unknown. There are things people experience but never talk about. A shadow moving in the corner, flickering of the lights, a disembodied voice. We invite you to talk with us. Share your story, share your experience. Because this isn't just your story, this is our story. This is Ghost Box Radio with Greg Bakken.
And this is Ghost Box Radio on AM 950, where every night we talk about the paranormal, ufology, Bigfoot, and so much more. My name is Greg Bakken, and thank you very much for joining me tonight. Before we get started, I do have to share something, because this is our second night going nightly, and I remember we've been talking about doing this for months. You know, it's been a long, like, road to get here. And one of the first things I said to myself when I said that I was going to be doing a nightly show, because I know myself and I know that I love snacks, that I said to myself, you can do this, but you got to make sure that you do not stop at Quick Trip on the way home. I'm about 30 minutes from here. Don't stop at Quick Trip. Don't get a snack. Just go home and go to bed. So I knew that at some point I'll break that. I mean, I'm only human over here. Some may argue with that, but it's true. And I broke it the first night. I went straight to Quick Trip, and I got Doritos, and I got cheese so I can make my own kind of nachos, and I got a pop, and I totally ruined it. I knew I was going to do it at some point, but night number one. So, I mean, I've been watching myself balloon, and for those of you on Facebook can have a real-time look of me ballooning over the course of the next few months, I suppose. Hopefully it's going to reverse, but you never know. But what are you all doing? You know, are you all, for those of you who are trying to take care of yourselves, how is that working out for you? I've been seeing some success stories on Facebook amongst my friends, but boy, I'd love to know what you're all doing, because I'm having a real tough time. I lost 80 pounds in 2020. And now it's just like there's a point that you stop eating healthy, even though you're trying to, and it just starts like adding back up. So anyway, that is where I'm at. And I've got to be like, tonight, don't stop at Quick Trip. Don't stop at Quick Trip. I think we know where we're going, though. So we'll see. I'll update you all tomorrow. I am really excited tonight, because I'm going to talk to a friend I haven't actually spoken to, voice to voice in probably about 6 years. And I'm a great big fan of him. Michael J. Warden is a retired law enforcement officer and researcher and award-winning author of historical true crimes. He is the author of two historical true crime books, the award-winning Lynched by a Mob, the 1892 lynching of Robert Lewis in Port Jervis, New York, published in May of 2022, and the 2013 book, The Murder of Richard Jennings, The True Story of New York's First Murder for Hire. During his 22 years in law enforcement, Michael served in the ranks of patrolman, detective, and sergeant. During his tenure as detective, Michael investigated major crimes, including four homicide investigations. He received training in crime scene photography, crime scene processing, and evidence collection. Michael has been specialized training in death investigations for vulnerable populations, including children and elderly adults. Michael approaches the genre of true crime from a unique perspective and presents a complete story of the crimes and aftermath, as well as the stories of the people involved. His books are well-researched and historically relevant to historians and researchers, as well as written in a style that makes them accessible to anyone interested in history and true crime. Michael, welcome to Ghost Box Radio.
Greg, thank you for having me back. I was very excited when we scheduled this because, like you said, you know, we keep in touch on social media, but nothing like talking face to face or voice to voice like this.
Well, so. and you know, last time I talked to you, you weren't the big shot that you are now. I mean, stop it. Not me. Yeah, okay.
Nope.
When we last spoke, you were not on television, which you have been now. You were part of, and what was that? Haunted Hotels, Paranormal Hotels? What was that called?
Hotel Paranormal.
You know, I'm getting there. Yeah. And so, and you were not like on a segment. You were a regular contributor to the show, right?
Yeah, I was a contributor in every episode for both seasons that were recorded.
That's cool. And I was so excited. But then the last time I spoke to you, I think that's when you were starting your UFO podcast at that point.
Yes, and we're still doing that. My friend and good researcher friend, Linda Zimmerman, we still do that on a monthly basis. It's a lot of fun. Get to explore some interesting topics, a little bit off of what I would normally be looking into when it comes to, you know, true crime. But it's still, nonetheless, it involves research, which I love.
Well, and that's just it, right? I mean, because that's, I mean, we're not even talking about the book aspects, right? We're talking about your bio. First of all, thank you for your service that you provided us. Even though I'm not in the same city as you are, but you had, since we last spoke, you had retired, right?
Yes. June of 2021, I retired after 22 years of service.
That's incredible. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And just, I mean, just the wealth of knowledge that, I mean, we could spend easily an hour on each of the things that we were talking about in your bio, from your evidence collection to crime scene processing and crime scene photography. And all of that has to be extraordinarily helpful when you're looking and doing the research into these books.
Absolutely. And before I even get into that, I just want to tell you about your midnight snacking.
Yeah.
The last 5 years of my career, I was the overnight sergeant by choice, by the way.
Sure.
I had picked the shifts. I wanted nights. And in the nice weather, there was nothing worse than being on the road and having to go to like the local convenience store and getting peanut butter cups, Doritos.
Oh.
And of course, sticking peanut butter cups in the air conditioning vent on a nice midnight shift and getting them nice and cold.
Mm-hmm.
I feel your pain.
Oh my God. I could feel thy pain when I try to put pants on, you know, I mean, they don't fit.
That happened to me.
and, you know, I mean, this is way too much information. And for those tuning in for paranormal, this is kind of paranormal, I guess, kind of moving on to the elastic, you know, shorts and stuff at the moment. It's embarrassing, quite frankly, but yeah, I mean, that's just it. And I mean, I suppose did you have to kind of keep track of all that though when you were still a detective? Because I mean, I'm assuming that they want you to be in some kind of decent shape.
You know, I was much better as a detective. You know, I kept myself a little bit thinner, and then I got promoted to sergeant, and it just you know, didn't have to wear suits anymore. Those suits got very tight.
Yeah,
I actually lost a lot of weight recently, and I can fit back into them, thankfully. But
I was gonna say,
you know, just.
You look really good. I mean, I was going to say, yeah, you've really, and that's the journey though, isn't it? It's like, yeah, it's really tough to do it. But once you get there, it's incredible. Now I got to ask you, do you have any like fears of gaining it back? And I ask it that way because when I did lose the 80 pounds, I would have dreams that I was as big basically as I am now and be like, oh my gosh, in the dreams, it's like the nightmare is like, my gosh, I have all this weight back on me again. Everything I just did is for naught.
I do have those dreams. And the way I really lost most of the weight was I cut out the junk, especially candy, sugary stuff, because I have no willpower, no self-control.
No.
You know, if I have a bag of Oreos, you know, a serving size is like two Oreos. I could eat a sleeve of Oreos in a sitting.
Oh, yeah. No, that's
I'm okay as long as I don't start. I can look at a piece of nice chocolate cake and not want it. I can't take a bite because if I take one bite, forget it. The piece is gone within 30 seconds and I'm on my second or third. So
absolutely.
I know if I stay away from it, I'm okay.
So I promise we're going to get to your book at some point. but the thing is, too, it's like, what's cruel about this situation, I choose my words very carefully, cruel, is that it's like I pass all these convenience stores and stuff on the freeway coming back home. That's not a big deal. But I take my exit and the roundabout, and there is the Quick Trip. So, yeah. You know, it's like, you know, it's basically begging me to go in there. I mean, it's, right? It's like a siren. beckoning.
I think in the legal system, we would call that coercion. Yeah, you're being coerced. This isn't your fault. I'm telling you.
No, it's not my fault. None of it's my fault.
It's entrapment.
The fact that I can also eat a sleeve of Oreos, it's not my fault. All right, let's do this. Since I wasted a segment talking about my dietary habits, why don't we do this? And let's take our first break. And when we come back, we're going to get into Michael's book. We're going to have a great conversation tonight. Plus, we want your comments, too. You're listening to Ghost Box Radio on AM 950. And welcome back to Ghost Box Radio on AM 950. My name is Greg Bach, and thank you. Thank you so very much for joining me today. We have my guest, author Michael J. Warden, and we're talking about his book this hour, Lynched by a Mob, The 1892 Lynching Robert Lewis in Port Jervis, New York. Michael, I guess the question I want to start with is, can we get a little bit of background on what this book is about, please?
Yeah, so this book is about a pretty dark part of the history in the city I grew up in, Port Jervis. And in 1892, June 2nd, a mob basically seized a local African-American man named Robert Lewis from the police before they could even get him into the jail. And they dragged him about a quarter of a mile through the streets, beating him until they hanged him not once but twice from a tree. He had been accused of sexually assaulting a local popular white female, and the crowd was going to exact their revenge. Now, there was a big push to try to save him at the time. People did intervene, but they couldn't outwin the mob. And ultimately, no one's held accountable, even though people, credible witnesses, do testify. So it's a very shameful story, but one that needed to be told because it's the only lynching in the state of New York outside of 1863.
So this lynching that took place, 131 years ago, they don't know, no one's being held, you said no one's being held accountable for it.
Right. No one was ever indicted for murder. No one was ever put on trial for any of the crimes committed against him that evening. So it's technically an unsolved homicide in the city of Port Jervis.
So immediately, and forgive me, I mean, I don't think that this is the case per se, but is there people working on the inside protecting other people from allowing them not to be indicted then?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. You know, Port Jervis is a very small, tight-knit community. It still today it is, but more so, you know, in 1892, 131 years ago. And the people that were involved in the mob, these weren't the ruffians, the railroaders, the drunken out-of-towners that the newspapers would have liked people to think. These were prominent citizens. You know, these were business owners. They were lawyers. Yeah. They were potentially former police officers. They were doctors. So, you know, we had a couple of really good witnesses come forward who didn't care, but there was definitely some intimidation, some fear, and, you know, whether it was implied or explicit, that definitely played a role.
What about through your research, even now, do you feel, and maybe this is just crazy talk, but did you feel any resistance from anybody in Port Jervis that didn't want this to be drug up again?
You know, during most of the research, I didn't really run into any resistance, but I also wasn't out there in the public advertising what I was doing. It was known by, you know, people that knew me. But after the book was released locally on Facebook, especially, there were some comments about, you know, oh, it's 130 years ago. Why now? Why can't we let the history just die? Why are we bringing this up again? It's, you know, one person even wrote, oh, 130 years ago. Why are we bringing this up? Oh, that's right. Let's write a book and get rich. And I actually responded to that one and said, listen, if you know how to get rich off of a history book, please tell me how, because I'm in the hole right now on the research end.
Oh, I'm sure. I mean, before I get into the question about research, because that has to be its own incredibly fascinating story there. But I don't know. I just feel like that there is something about all this that makes me think, like, a book like this is always good to come out. Now, I erroneously thought it just came out. I was misreading what you wrote. It was 2022. For some reason, I thought it was this year. So I'm really not paying attention as well as I should. But I'm always afraid of history repeating itself. And a book like this is kind of a good reminder to people that, you know, when you think that stuff is too far in the past now, right, that this would never happen again. I find that's when we as a civilization get very surprised.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's also a great example of how ordinary people can do extremely sadistic, evil things, such as, you know, hang a man two times after beating him viciously. And, you know, people like to think of criminals as, you know, monsters, and that the mob must have been a bunch of monsters, for example. They don't like to confront the fact that the people in the mob looked like everyone else in the village. They weren't monsters. They weren't sadistic killers. They were church-going people, God-fearing. And that I think, is the scariest lesson from the book, that how easily ordinary good people can become pretty bad very fast and then go right back to their lives and be normal, good people again.
We're talking with author Michael J. Warden. We're talking about his book, Lynched by a Mob, the 1892 lynching of Robert Lewis in Port Jervis, New York. And, you know, at the time, was there any, even though no one was indicted, were there anybody that was kind of looked at as being the possible, like the head of the lynching, or the person who really had it out for Robert Lewis, or any sort of like prominent person involved in this?
So what's interesting is there's like kind of a dual answer to your question. The first one is that complicating this whole story is, at the time, it's alleged that a white man named PJ Foley, mm-hmm. who was in town, he had been an insurance salesman. He was a, you know, lover of Lena McMahon. They had been in a relationship and she had broke it off and was not allowed to see him. Well, the allegation was that he had set up Robert Lewis to assault Lena McMahon. In fact, Lewis confessed that to his captors when he was arrested by civilians, that he had been put up to it, and said, you know, basically, she likes it rough, so she'll just play along. So almost like maybe he wasn't told to assault her versus, you know, she's game to, you know, get busy here, but you're going to have to pretend that she might fight. So immediately the community focused on PJ Foley. He gets arrested, and in a big, you know, blackmail hearings are held. There are people named as being also central to the lynching. One of them being a local law student named Raymond Carr, whose father is an extremely well-off, well-respected attorney in the city, the village at the time. And, you know, it's him who, underneath the tree, there's a big standoff, and there's actually a moment where it looks like they might save him. And he's alleged to have uttered the final incendiary words that caused him to be hanged the second time and die. So it's a very, very complicated answer, because so much more was going on at the time.
Clearly time itself had to make it difficult for you to kind of untangle any sort of this mess, right? Because there's so many people involved.
Yes. I mean, no official records locally could be found. So, for example, the coroner's inquest by law should have had a transcript made. That's what the law required. Now, did they have one? I don't know. I couldn't find one. I couldn't find one at the county clerk's office where it should have been filed. So in that case, I had to reconstruct the entire coroner's inquest from testimony that had been quoted in the local newspapers. So I had to basically take multiple newspaper sources and go witness by witness and compare everything that was said in each newspaper, and then do that for every witness, keeping track of every source, by the way. So if they said it in, say, for example, the Evening Gazette, I had to make sure that that sentence or paragraph was specifically attributed to the Evening Gazette, because it might have been written differently in the next page, the Tri-State Union, for example. It was maddening.
Oh, I'm sure. I mean, how many newspapers were around at that point in that area?
So in Port Jervis, there was the Dailies, the Evening Gazette, sure. and the Port Jervis Union. And then there was a weekly, the Tri-State Union. But you also had the neighboring cities, like the city of Middletown at the time had local newspapers who had reporters here. You had the city newspapers who had reporters in Port Jervis stationed out of the newspaper offices to get the scoop, so to speak. In fact, they were kind of like mini celebrities at the time that people recognized them, like, ooh, that's the man from the New York World, for example.
Yeah.
You know.
Wow. I mean, you're having to cross-reference between them, right? And the period of time that it takes. I want to talk a lot more about the process of research and stuff, because that's very fascinating to me. But let's do this. Let's take one more break. When we come back, we'll talk more process of research. Keep talking with Michael, and just keep this conversation going. You're listening to Ghost Box Radio on AM 950. We know we've been talking about it for a while now, and we just want to once again say that this Friday over at the Grand House in Rush City, Minnesota, we're doing a special event where we are playing pretty much an investigation that we had that yielded a ton of results, all sorts of different types of evidence that we're going to be playing, whether it's EVP, spirit box, disembodied voices, knocks, all sorts of things. And we have paperwork that someone on our team found to actually be able to confirm some of the stuff that happened at this event. That's this Friday at 6:30 p.m. The presentation starts. $10 to get in for the presentation, but you can also come early. And around 5:30, the doors are open for a wonderful buffet dinner. That's an additional cost, but we'd love to see you there. And then, of course, we didn't really talk about it, but also I just want to remind folks that there is the question of the week. If you could only meet one, would you rather meet a spirit of a loved one, an alien, or a Bigfoot? And if you could just put your answer, people have been putting their answer in the Facebook chats. You can also send me an email, comment at ghostboxradio.com. That's comment at ghostboxradio.com. And let me know what you think. We'll run it. We'll pick up some of the answers from what we get this week, and I'm gonna read them during the Friday show. So please, definitely, if you have a chance, send us a note. We'd love to hear from you. We continue our conversation now with author Michael J. Warden. We're talking about his book, Lynched by a Mob, the 1892 Lynching of Robert Lewis in Port Jervis, New York. You know, Michael, this is a very sad situation. The book is a very sad subject. Did it affect you that way when you're going through everything that led up to it and how it ended? I mean, on a personal level.
It affected me on a personal level two different ways. One was the level of brutality in which Robert Lewis is murdered.
Yeah.
You know, for years, none of the details were really known about this other than, you know, he was hanged, he was, you know, lynched, and this is why. And it was pretty rough. They beat him up a little bit. But yeah. When I broke down the night of the lynching and, you know, I tried to break it down as if you were there, it's probably as reliably accurate as we can get based upon, you know, the passage of 130 years, basically. But the level of brutality that local people committed against another local man. Robert Lewis was a yeah. local man. He knew his killers, and his killers knew him. And then on top of that, he's remembered by the wrong name. Robert Lewis isn't even his name. It's Robert Murray, but he's known as Jackson. So for 130 years, he's been stripped of his actual identity. That to me was another injustice. But there was another real touching part, and that was the story of Lena McMahon.
Yeah.
The victim of the assault, because Lena McMahon's life really takes a tragic downward spiral. She was a smart young woman, pretty, a graduate of the local academy, which was basically like high school at a time when most people weren't going to high school or graduating.
Mm-hmm.
She ran a candy shop. Her parents were well liked, and, you know, they end up leaving Port Jervis eventually, but Lena shows up in 1894 in New York City at the Cosmopolitan Hotel with the decomposing remains of an infant in a drawer.
Oh my.
So yeah, she makes headlines again with that. And you know, there's references that you know, her mind had been shattered by the assault and the aftermath. Lena, the baby had been born deceased. It was a stillborn baby.
Sure. Yeah.
So she ultimately wasn't charged with a crime. But after that, she had disappeared from everything. No other researcher that's even peeked at this case came close to finding out what happened to her. And I was determined that I was not going to finish the book till I found her. And it took me 2 years.
So you did find out.
I tracked her to 1900. And then I lost her for the longest time between 1900 and 1910. I finally found her in 1910. Then nothing and nothing. And I had one of those aha break moments. And I got to tell you, the day I realized her death date, how she died, where she died, I was actually genuinely upset. I actually said to my wife that morning, I said, you know, Lena McMahon's dead. And she kind of looked at me and said, yeah, wouldn't she be like 170 years old? I'm like, and it dawned on me, like I had a very intimate connection to her. She was alive to me until I had that concrete evidence that this is when and where she died and how she died. And I actually went up to her grave. It's up in Massachusetts. To visit her grave. And I read a poem, which she had sang a song in elementary school as a performance. And I actually found that song and I read it at her graveside. And I get a little emotional. I did at that moment. And I still kind of think about it that way because she was a forgotten victim too.
I think it's a very forgotten part of the role of the researcher that you are individually looking, you're dipping into these people's lives, and it's almost like you're reading the book, and you at one point you come to where the story ends, and it's not what you expect or what you want it to be, but it doesn't matter. That's how it is, and you start to get really attached, I suppose, to the people you're researching.
Yes. You know, even with Robert Lewis, for example, I was going through a Civil War pension file for his father, mm-hmm. or at least the man who raised him. And, you know, I'm flipping through these digitized pages from the National Archives, and I come across a page, and then I come across another page with his signature on it, Robert L. Murray. Two different times, because he was educated. He could read and write. And there on a piece of paper, albeit a, you know, digitized reproduction, a scan, was this man's signature. It still survives. You know, 130 years after his murder, I'm holding a document or a reproduction of a document that this man signed, which to me blew me away. It was such a personal connection, the signature.
I suppose that's something, too, that I'm assuming that you're very cognizant about when you're writing about making sure to bring out the humanity of these people and their lives, because it is easy just to be like, well, you know, Robert Lewis and Port Jervis, this is what happened to him. Here's the facts. But it is important to remember that these are human beings, that these are lives that you're going back to. And I suppose that's something that maybe it's just not for everybody, but for me, it is easy to kind of forget because it is the past. It is so long ago. But the fact is that they had these lives and they were shattered.
Right. And, you know, for example, Robert Lewis's mother, you know, she was still alive when he was killed. Mm. She was living in Paterson, New Jersey. She came up for the funeral. There's a horrible description. I put it in the book where, you know, she asked the undertaker to open the coffin before they lowered it so she could see him one last time and how she broke down graveside. Gosh. And, you know, I wanted to learn more about his mom. And, you know, she lives a very long life after this. You know, I wanted to put more of a human face to everybody. A lot of true crime focuses on the relevant facts. And I think I excel at that as well. But I also look at it like the spokes of a wheel. I want to hit everything else involved. Who were these people? What were their stories and what happened to them afterwards?
How many years did it take you to research this?
I made the commitment in 2018 to write this book. I had been interested over the years that I've been researching true crime locally. Mm-hmm. So I had some articles about it. I knew the general process. It's actually my late grandmother's the one who prompted me to really write it because her aunt her, you know, her mother's half sister was there during the sexual assault and treated Lena McMahon.
Okay.
So I had heard this growing up, but in 2018, my grandmother basically told me I should write a book about it because I would do a great job.
Mm-hmm.
So 2018 is when I said, okay, and I delved into the research and I, you know, COVID hit, 2020, 21 slowed things down dramatically. Places were closed. You know, couldn't get copies from the National Archives. In fact, I actually got an order I put in 2020. I just got it about 3 weeks ago. Fulfilled for a pension file.
Yeah.
Thank God there was nothing relevant in it that I could have been like, oh my gosh, groundbreaking that I could find. But you know, fortunately, a lot of places operated with one person and they were great. You know, I would call them, I would email them, and people would scan documents. They were emailing things, newspapers. I'd be like, I really need this newspaper. And they're like, well, I can't send you the microfilm because we're not doing that, but I'll get the page and I'll scan it and make sure I get it to you. I mean, these people were wonderful. You know, they didn't have to go out of their way.
No,
they did. So, you know, I am so appreciative to so many people whose names I didn't even get sometimes.
Wow.
So it could have been done quicker. And I'm very stubborn.
Yeah.
When for Lena McMahon, for example, I wasn't writing it till I had her. I had that information and, you know, it just, I wasn't going to do it. I wasn't going
to
budge.
Do you see that as like a personal promise to her?
I do in a way, maybe subliminally.
Yeah.
That was one of my commitments when I set my goals to writing the book. That was one of them. I wanted to tell her story and what happened to her. And to me, not telling that left the book incomplete.
And just the fact you went to her grave, it tells that you wanted to celebrate her life in a sense, you know, to pay tribute. Mm-hmm. I mean, that says something, because that's more than just trying to get the facts in the book. That's I really appreciate that. That's really interesting.
Yeah. That to me, it's, you know, some researchers don't get involved in any personal level. Whereas I look at it like that's an important part of telling the story. You know, I'm not allowing it to sway my opinion, but it's remembering that Lena McMahon was a young woman with a very promising future who had that stolen from her and died very tragically, very young. You know, telling her story is important. Finding the graves of people involved, people that either tried to stop it, maybe some of the people alleged to have done it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to me, again, it's important. Trying to find where Robert Lewis is buried. His grave location specifically is no one knows exactly where it is. I've been able to put a circle on the map where I think it is, based upon my research, but I can't put in X marks the spot.
That's interesting. Now, with all the research that you've done, and I'm sure that you overdid it, I'm sure, for the book, what kind of percentage has been left out just because it may not be relevant, or it just doesn't fit into the volume that you created?
There was probably, I would say I ended up cutting out 15-20% of research I did, maybe a little bit more.
Yeah.
A lot of photographs had to be removed because, you know, I wrote the book in chapters out of order. I didn't know what chapter. I had no idea how the book would be ordered. So I wrote it all over the place. And, you know, my friend Linda Zimmerman, who is my paranormal investigator and great friend, you know, I would talk to her. She'd be like, how many pages are you thinking? I'm like, probably like 120, 200. And she'd be like, okay, that's good. Another good friend at the local historical society, Nancy, who is the executive director, same thing. You know, I was very close with her working on this project. She was a great resource. How many pages do you think? You know, 125. Well, between the text, you know, the actual chapters, the bibliography, the end notes and everything else, it's a 444 page book.
It is.
And it's fully illustrated too.
Yeah. Yeah, and that is a very good point, that you're making your points with the illustration from the, and stuff from the time of it all happening. And it's very fascinating that you can find in, very fascinating that you can see all that. Let's do this. Let's go ahead, and we're going to take our final break here. When we come back, we're going to finish our conversation with Michael J. Warden, and we'll take any questions that come in. You're listening to Ghost Box Radio on AM 950.
We'll be right back.
And join us tomorrow as we're going to have on Angie Sturm, who runs the Bell Mansion in Fort Wayne, Indiana. It's one of the things that I want to do on the show is bring some of these haunted locations and the people who run them onto the show to talk about their locations, talk about what's going on there. Because, first of all, I'm a huge fan of architecture and older buildings and that sort of thing. But also, if you know, a lot of people who are listening, they're always like, "Ooh, I want to go on a haunted road trip. I want to go to places that are, you know, have some sort of like, you know, spooky background and stuff." And I want to bring some of those places to you so you could make up your mind. Maybe it's a place you want to visit. Angie is amazing, and I'm looking forward to her tomorrow. Then Thursday, we're going to have Father Kenneth Torres on. We're going to be talking about demonology, a nice little light subject that we'll be hitting on Thursday. And then Friday, of course, is Casual Friday. We'll be talking about all sorts of paranormal news. We're going to listen and we're going to read some letters, and we're going to have a great time. Well, I'm going to have a great time at least. But let's finish our conversation with author Michael J. Warden. We're talking about his book, Lynched by a Mob, the 1892 Lynching of Robert Lewis in Port Jervis, New York. And Michael, is this book just available through Amazon? Because that's where I saw it. Or do you have your own website where people could get it?
So I have a website. I'm at the moment not selling it through the website, only because I am so bad with fulfilling mail order at the moment. But it can be purchased on any online bookseller. I will put my website up real quick. I'm just going to type it out here.
Okay.
And I just wanted to mention real quick that the book did earn this year the 2023 two awards in true crime, the top awards in the Next Generation Indie Book Awards and in the Independent Publisher Book Awards. So two gold medals and two different award organizations in true crime. So I was very honored to have it recognized by multiple people as being something special.
Absolutely. Well, it is. And congratulations on that. That is fantastic news. And I am really happy to see that your hard work is really paying off, because that sort of dedication to that research cannot be easy. And, you know, we have about 6 minutes left before end of the show. You know, your background in working with the police is so in depth. What do you bring to the research with that background that you have?
So a lot of it is that dogged determination to get to the truth.
Yeah.
You know, to uncover everything you can. You know, if you're at a crime scene, you don't just stop because you've collected one or two potential items of evidence. Mm-hmm. You process the scene and collect everything which might be evidence. You can always go back later and evaluate whether or not it's relevant, but you have to collect it at the time. Working backwards, you know, when a crime has happened and you don't have the crime scene, then of course it goes down to interviews, reading what other people have said, trying to read between the lines. So I like that challenge of these old historical crimes, because mm-hmm. no one's around to talk to. So you have to go with what's available. And what I find is, it's partly, you know, sort of like drives me, is what else can I find that no one else has, you know, like,
yeah,
so I try.
And, you know, you mentioned that earlier on that all the files that went around to that case, We're all gone. And I don't remember if you said destroyed or not, but I mean, were they destroyed?
No. So I did locate a lot of the original court files
over
at the county clerk's office. I mean, I accessed a lot of original grand jury files and stuff. The coroner's inquest I haven't found, but I'm going back over there to look for files again.
Mm-hmm.
And they're great. They love the history, preserving it. So I'll be digging. And of course, I'll probably find it because the book is out.
Right. Well, I mean, what happens? What happens in that situation that, say, you find something that is absolutely like, this needs to be included? Do you just put up like an addendum on a website somewhere, or do you try to do like an updated volume down the road? Well, what do you think?
It happened when the book went to the publisher to be published, because I found a first hand account at the Menacing Valley Historical Society in a place where I know I'd looked, and I went into a panic. It was a 4-page typed. Fortunately, there was a problem with the cover,
mm-hmm.
and they had to reject the file. And I was able to quickly add an addendum to the back of the book with the original. So I would have to do an addendum. I would probably cry for about 3 days of all the work I have to do and did. But I do want to add to it. There's 635 sources in the book. It's astronomical.
It is.
But I wrote the book so that it's an easy, enjoyable read, as enjoyable as the topic can be, because there's nothing worse than a history book, which has got a lot of great information, but it can put you to sleep. I've seen them like that.
Yeah, absolutely.
They've done it to me.
Yeah.
So I didn't want this to be that book. I wanted it, if you want the history, you can follow the citations. If you just want to read it for the information and the story, you can easily do that as well. It's not a technical read. You don't have to be a historian or have a PhD or something to access this story.
And I think that's important. Obviously, you think it's very important, but it is important, isn't it? So that you want people to be able to access this, and it's not for book sales or anything. It's so that the history can be seen correctly, I suppose.
Yes, absolutely. I didn't write this book to make it rich. I wrote this book to tell a story, and I wanted to tell the best story I could as accurately as I could, and I accomplished both of those.
And nobody writes books like this with the amount that you put into it and gets rich, quite frankly.
No one does. And I'm okay with that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Otherwise you wouldn't be doing it. Now, is there anything next anything you're writing that you could share with us that you are working on or anything?
Yeah. So I'm working on a 1903 homicide in Port Jervis, which occurred two doors away from where I grew up on Rumsey Street. No one knew about it. The perpetrator of the crime, there's some allegations it was a love triangle.
Mm-hmm.
The perpetrator went to the electric chair in Sing Sing a year later. So this is a lost case no one's ever even heard of in Port Jervis till now. And I actually have some photographs that were in a criminal file that was published by the Court of Appeals. The photographs taken at the crime scene, like after the crime. So it doesn't have the body and all that. But it's a great case because it used some forensics mm-hmm. at a time when that wasn't popular. And, you know, the guy goes to an electric chair. That's not very common.
No. Wow. No. So you got to keep us up to date on that. You got to also quickly, what's your website address?
It's www.michaeljwarden.com. Michaeljwarden.com.
Make sure you get out there, folks. Make sure you're out there to check out, because he has more books out there, and you have books on mm-hmm. different subjects and stuff. And it's super, super important that everybody has a chance to go out there, take a look, and buy the books. Support these authors are putting so much into it. Michael, thank you so very much for being on the show today.
Thank you.
I mean, this has been very eye-opening, and like I said, I have the book, and I need to actually sit down and read it, especially with all the work that you've put into it. Michael, thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is it for tonight's edition of Ghost Box Radio. We're going to be back tomorrow with Angie Strum. We're going to be talking about the Bell Mansion. We're going to be talking about haunted locations. It's going to be a fantastic program. Thank you for joining us, and we'll see you tomorrow.